I am so happy to be here with you today. It's a very special time in my life. For all my life, I have had certain things that I wanted to complete, but the most important of all of them has been to try to put out a version of my guru's commentaries on the Bhagavad Gita. This only since 1995, because I expected it to be a good version before, but it wasn't what I wanted. It wasn't as I remembered it. And with God's grace, I have been given a very good memory. And so, in just a short time, it's unbelievably short, I was able to write this whole book. I began on October 7th of last year, and it was Jyoti Shindevi who practically drove me to it, because they were to come on October 7th. And I thought, well, once they come, the energy will shift. And I've been sort of trying in different ways to think, how can I approach this work? And it just wasn't coming. When I had this thought, oh my God, they're coming tonight, then I just was pushed over the edge. And from then on, it's really quite amazing. Because a book like this is, you can't write 600 pages in 2 months. It's just not humanly possible, especially for somebody who is extremely conscious of style and clarity and doing all the work that the many, many writers leave it to the reader to figure out what they mean. I have always felt that my job as a writer is to make things as clear as possible for the reader. With all these considerations, to think that I could finish it, starting it on October 7th, finish it on December 5th. That's less than 2 months. It's unbelievable, and yet it happened. And more than that, you would think, well, in that case, the editing process must have taken a long time. When I wrote my book, The Path, it took me a year to edit it. And I figured this would surely take quite a bit of time, but yet, on the other hand, as I wrote it, it seemed to flow just like a stream. And when I actually sat down to edit it, I began on a Tuesday morning and finished on a Tuesday morning 3 weeks later. Hard to believe. But as I read it, I think, it's just what I want it to be. I'm so thrilled. I cannot tell you. I feel my guru wrote it through me. And I wanted today to talk about the symbolism of the Gita, the symbolism of the scripture it's based on, and symbolism in scripture in general, the allegory of it all, the whole Mahabharata. It's a rousing story, but it's much more than that. It has a very deep meaning. If you don't, as Lahiri Maharshi put, if you don't understand the key points of meaning, then all you get is a good story. I remember when I was in college, I was asked, along with all my class, to write an essay on my criterion or my criteria for great literature. And I came up with a very weird answer. I said that I find that great works of art have a certain light in them, great works of literature. I said that when I hold the Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, I see a blinding, blazing, golden white light. When I hold Shakespeare in my hand, I see a beautiful blue or red gold. When I hold Chaucer, it's sort of a nice brown. And most books have no light at all. It reminds me also of Milarepa, the great Tibetan yogi, who he had to commit, out of obedience to his mother, a great sin. Relatives of theirs had taken away her property after the death of her husband, and she wanted her son to get even with them. And he learned black magic and killed all those relatives. And then he suddenly woke up and realized what a great sin he had committed and how he didn't want to go through lifetime after lifetime expiating that sin. And he just wondered, is there some way that I can expiate that sin and find freedom in this lifetime? And he went to different teachers and finally came to Guru Marpa, who had brought the science of yoga from India. And the Guru Marpa had to submit him to such tests that would bring him to the point of absolute discouragement several times before he could expiate that karma, just feeling that he'd absolutely blown it. So he would have him build a house on a hill, and just as the house was being completed, he'd say, "Wait a minute, you fool, I told you to build it here." And the poor fellow had to take down all those bricks, carry them over, put it up. He saw him the next time. He said, "Oh, I must have been drunk when I said that. That's not what I meant." Imagine a yogi being drunk. Anyway, here's where I wanted. He got him to the point of absolute despair several times before he would even give him initiation. But then when he received initiation, such had been his determination built up by these great tests that he had gone through, that he became the greatest yogi of the history of Tibet. Well, these tests that we have to go through are a part of the whole journey of life. You cannot really describe scripture in literal ways because our minds are completely confused by what looks to us to be reality. The chair you're sitting on, which I hope won't become too hard in this time that I'm speaking, is in fact, however, not hard at all. It's only energy. How can spirit, when spirit brought the universe into manifestation, it was all consciousness. He didn't have atoms to sort of assemble into all the different forms that we see in the universe and in the world around us. He didn't have anything. There was only consciousness. And so what could he do? He had to vibrate that consciousness. Now, how can a vibration of consciousness produce a hard chair? Oh, all right, your chairs, I hope, are soft. The hard floor. Well, okay. How could they? Have you noticed how when a propeller turns on an airplane, when it's turning fast enough, it looks like a solid disc? You take the tines of a tuning fork, when they're moving, it looks like a solid thing until they gradually slow down, become only two tines. And so it is that you see that vibration, when it's fast enough, rapid enough, it can produce the illusion of something solid. In that way, the countless vibrations of consciousness have produced everything that we are, everything that we see, everything around us. It is all a great delusion. In the beginning was the Word, is what St. John says in the Gospel of St. John. The Word means the vibration of Om. That vibration of Om, when the Infinite Spirit decided to produce, to create, he vibrated himself, and that vibration was the great sound of Om. To retrace your footsteps back to God, you need to commune with Om and merge in it. But how could God do that? Only through vibration. And it's such a different reality from the one we see that it's very difficult to teach spiritual truths without a certain amount of allegory. And so it is that we find the scriptures often are given in allegorical form. Almost always, in one way or another, they are allegory. And so we read, for example, in the Bible how the Jews escaped bondage in Egypt and searched for the Holy Land. Well, if you look at the map of the Gaza Desert, which they spent 40 years crossing, you'd almost think that a frog could leap across it. Of course, when you get down there, it's much more than that, but 40 years? Doesn't seem possible. And this promised land, I remember somebody writing a sort of satirical piece that, well, God, thank you for giving us this promised land of milk and honey, but frankly, our Arab friends here have oil, and we'd much rather have oil. But the truth is that the promised land is the infinite. Cosmic consciousness is what God has promised to all of us. But he has put us into separate egos, given us this illusion of being separate from each other, from everything else, giving us this delusion that we have this ego to defend. And the whole journey of the spiritual path is learning that this ego is just like, you might, to use another metaphor, a sliver of glass in the sunlight. When the sun is shining on that sliver of glass, it's got light. As soon as the sun goes down, there is no light. And so it is that this ego and this consciousness of ours has light only to the extent that it is enlightened by a higher truth. Our ego is an illusion. It's a very real seeming illusion, but there's no reality in it. And many people have said, well, but if I don't have a sense of ego, how can I be conscientious in what I do? How can you write all the books you've written and try to make them as good as you can without ego? The truth of it is that without ego, you can do much more. When you can reach the point where he can do it through you, it's just amazing what you can accomplish. When you can say, God, you do it. And suddenly you find the inspiration and you know how to do it. That's how this book was written. I didn't have to think, what shall I say? It was almost dictated to me. I knew what to say. I knew the words to use. I knew the rhythms, the everything. And I think it's a wonderful work. It's not my work, so I can praise it to the skies. The allegory here, however, it's also in the Pilgrim's Progress. It is the story of the individual soul taking its journey all the way up to that promised land of cosmic consciousness. The Iliad and the Odyssey of Homer, I feel, because of the light that I felt in them, that they are great works, but they're allegories again, and that meaning of that allegory has been lost. Whereas the Mahabharata, that meaning has been preserved by a culture that the only country in the world that has preserved its traditions and kept its high ideals has been India. It's the oldest country in the world. It's the most real country in the world. And I'm so pleased that President Bush is here now to help cement the relationship between these two countries. And I hope it lasts, because my guru said that someday India and America will work together to lead humanity on the path to right living, spiritually and materially. But I think that the greatest ambassador that India has ever sent to the West, not just America, to the West, was Paramahansa Yogananda. He somehow, by bringing the ideals of India and then not making it, he didn't make Americans into Indians, as many Swamis have done who have come to the West. He kept that culture and tried to make it spiritual. And so he didn't become an American, but he didn't lose his Indianness. And whereas Vivekananda, I've read a life of his written in America, but that he was, the Western materialism was something he could hardly handle. He didn't like it. Our guru was able somehow to ride with the waves. Those differences in vibration are very real. I remember when I lived in India before, and after a long time here, I had to go back. And I felt very sad at going back, because I could feel the sort of fog of materialism that emanates from countries that think first of material values and later of God. The one thing about the United States, however, is that whereas in South America, people went there from the West to find gold, in North America, people went there to find spiritual freedom. We have the Pilgrim Fathers. We have a great deal of foundation in spiritual seeking. And there has been, for that reason, Yogananda was sent to America, because he said that Americans wanted a technique, wanted some way by which they could experience what God and truth are all about. Now, Jyotish, would you bring that chair over here? I wasn't well yesterday, and I sort of would like to sit, if you'll excuse me. Thank you. That chair there. Thank you. I prefer, as a rule, to stand when I lecture. But today I don't know that I can stand and not fall down, so I think I'm safer. Thank you. Is it okay from here? Okay. Thank you. So, there is an ancient legend in India, which I was told about when I first came here in 1958, that Arjuna married a Mexican princess. I don't know if this is true, but many people have told me this. And Master said, my guru said, that there is a karmic link between India and America. You'll have to, when you read autobiography of a yogi, read it with great attention, because his tendency was to slip things in without any emphasis at all. And if you blink, you don't even notice what he said. He said somewhere that surely there is a karmic connection between the two. When he said that, you know that he means it. He didn't say anything idly. When he said that, I remember when I was talking to the monks at Mount Washington many years ago, I said, any page you pick up in the autobiography of a yogi, there's deep truth there. And one of them challenged me, said, well, give me an example. I just opened it up at random. And it said, thoughts are universally, not individually rooted. This is something that is being said here in the Gita also, that the gunas are sort of eternal wanderers. You can express any one of them according to what you're open to, but they don't define you. You are not those gunas. When you express goodness, it isn't that you are good, you're expressing goodness. When you express darkness, it's not that you are dark, you're expressing darkness. Our duty is to go beyond good and evil and into the infinite good, which has no limitations. This is the goal of life. And the Mahabharata describes this great descent of spirit into matter, and all those characters analyzed carefully display this descent of spirit into matter, matter into the individual soul turning back. But the most important symbol for the Bhagavad Gita, and the only one that essentially concerns us, because that's what the Bhagavad Gita treats of, is the discourse between Krishna and Arjuna. You know the story, I'm sure, that Krishna was lying asleep and Duryodhana and Arjuna both came to ask his help in the battle of Kurukshetra, war of Kurukshetra. And Arjuna sat humbly at Krishna's feet, and Duryodhana, without that humility, sat at his head. And when Krishna woke up, the first person he saw was Arjuna. But he said, I want to be fair to you, so I give you a choice. Either me, and I won't take part in the battle, I will just be there as a counselor, or my whole army, millions of soldiers. And Arjuna said, wherever you are, Lord, there is victory. I want only you. And Duryodhana was very pleased to get that whole army, because to him, material might spelled victory. And so we see that Krishna, in the Bhagavad Gita, as in the Mahabharata, did not actually even take part. This is what life is like, too. Arjuna's thought that Krishna could, wherever Krishna was, their victory was assured, is the truth. The Lord doesn't seem to come in and do things for us. You don't see him appear on a cloud. Somehow, however, when you're on his side, that is to say, you ask him to be on your side, when you seek him and don't seek material power, prowess, success, etc., you find that doors open unaccountably. I can tell you so many stories from our Ananda history that are just incredible that way. I remember just the first day I had already bought the land for the retreat. All the money I made in classes went toward buying property so that we could build a community. And I had bought this, but it sort of exhausted my money. And A doctor friend of mine, Dr. Runnels, in Sacramento, had an office that I stopped at. I used to give classes to the whole week to raise funds for building the community, and then I'd stop there sometimes to go on. And there was I stopped by his office, and there was a real estate agent there. And he told me he'd come upon the hottest land buy, as he called it, that he'd ever seen. And I said, well, where is it? He said, it's probably up around somewhere near you. And I didn't know what that meant. It could mean anywhere up to 80 or more miles away. But when I looked at the map, I saw that it was just 6 miles down the road from the land we already had. And so I said, well, would you like to show it to me? Yes. When would you like to go? Well, anytime you like. Would you like to go now? I said, yes. So we went up that same afternoon. Now, mind you, that morning, I had bought this land with several other people, Allen Ginsberg, Dick Baker, several others. I had bought one portion of it. They had bought other portions. And they were concerned when they heard that I was trying to build a community there. They envisioned a big city. And you know how imagination can play a role in these things. And so he sent me a letter which I received Friday morning saying, please don't do anything until I return from Japan in the fall. And the fall, in American terminology, means the autumn. This was June. This was definitely not the time to be waiting. I had people coming already. And I didn't know what to do. But that same day, this real estate agent said, well, let's go up. So I went up. I saw this land. It was the most beautiful land I'd ever seen. And I said, well, I'd like this parcel, this parcel, this parcel. It came to quite a few parcels of that whole property that had been broken up. And I said, well, these are the ones I would like. And he said, well, I'll try to get them off the board. He went in late that night, early in the morning, and took those pieces off the board. And when he came in the office, the other real estate agents were pleading with him, at least let us have this. He said, no, I've promised at least over the weekend. Well, over the weekend, I had to raise $13,500, at least in promises. That's not a small amount, and back in 1969, it was a lot of money, at least for somebody like me. I didn't know what to do, but I got on the phone, and I phoned lots of friends, and they all agreed to pitch in. I had the money by Monday morning. That was one of the miracles that just kept happening. I've told you a story, some of you, before, of how in 1972 I felt that Divine Mother wanted me to come back to India. And I had saved the money from classes and money that people had given me to go back for maybe 2 months. And I was in San Francisco about 2 weeks before. It was a Friday. And suddenly the rod on my car broke, and I realized it was time to get rid of it and get another car. But I had a choice. Either I got a new car or I went to India. I felt Divine Mother wanted me to go to India, but I knew that I'd have to come back. And without a car up there in the mountains, I would not be able to function. And so I said, Divine Mother, she didn't answer my prayers. I couldn't go to a church. I couldn't go anywhere. So I sat in a restaurant and over lunch tried to meditate. Not quite the way to meditate and get an answer. But that evening, I said, Divine Mother, my common sense tells me that I need a car when I come back. And if you really want me to go to India, this is the way I prayed. You may think it's a bit cheeky. But I said, Divine Mother, if you still want me to go to India, you're going to have to reimburse me. So I put down $1,100 on a good used car. And that was Friday night. Monday morning, I received a letter in the mail that said, it contained a check, and it said, use this as Divine Mother wants you to. The check was for $1,000. Now, how many people in America think of God as Divine Mother? How many people know that I think of God as Divine Mother? It seemed to me really an answer, because this way I was able to get the car, go to India, come back, everything worked out. I have seen this happen again and again. Divine Mother, God, Guru, whatever, like Krishna You don't see him there happening, we're doing it with you. It's through your faith that he does it. But somehow when you're on his side, things go right. And this is the point that many worldly people can't figure out. They say, well, I don't see him doing anything. But look at your life and see if things don't go better when you think of him and live for him. Faith is a very, very important part of your baggage, you might say, as a human being. If you really give things to God, you don't have to start picking it apart. You know, you sow a seed and then you pour water on it and you hope it'll grow. And then the next day you uncover it to see if it's growing. Well, it'll never grow like that. Leave it alone. But if you keep watering it and treat it right, it will suddenly grow. And the same thing with faith. I can tell you from many, many examples in my life, in my guru's life, in so many lives of people I know, that faith in God is the most practical thing of all. And so it was that Arjuna had Krishna as his charioteer. And Krishna would never do anything except advise him. Yes, indeed. And this is another thing that you have to take into account. God does intervene, and Krishna intervened once or twice. And you can expect that too, but you can't choose the moment. There's a story from the life of Saint Teresa of Avila. And this is something I say here in the Gita too, that when you've reached a certain point in your dedication to God, then he will come in and protect you. Teresa was somehow attracted to a young man, and he thought that he would be able to convince her to leave the monastery and marry him and so on. And he had come for that purpose when all of a sudden Jesus Christ appeared right next to him. And the man was talking exuberantly, and Jesus Christ looked calmly. And she just froze. She couldn't move. And my guru explained one time in church, telling that story, that when you've done enough to convince God that you mean it, he will also protect you. It isn't that he will keep piling you with tests until you, hoping you'll go under. It isn't that. He's on your side. He wants to save you. And so Teresa went on to become a great saint and indeed a great yogi. And I have good reason to believe that she was in a later life a disciple of Paramahansa Yogananda. And in the Bhagavad Gita, we see that Krishna takes care of Arjuna even though he doesn't seem to. This is the role of God. Now here we come to a very odd thing. You know that if a general is on the battlefield ready for the battle to begin the next day, he wouldn't be such a fool as to say, drive me between the lines of these two enemies. It's the most foolhardy thing anybody could do. I mean, they'd all be trained on him. I mean, who cares about tomorrow being the start? Let's just go ahead and get this bird while we can. It didn't happen that way. It's a symbol. It's an allegory. Actually, any general with any common sense at all would be standing on a mountaintop directing things from a safe distance where he could at least keep his body and soul together till he won the war. What happened was, and this is the allegory, it's really not a war. The Gita is true on all levels. There is such a thing as a righteous war. Mahatma Gandhi was a little bit idealistic in this respect, that somebody said to him, what if somebody came to your village and was shooting everybody up? What would you do? And Gandhi said, I would let him shoot me first. Well, big deal. So he shoots you and goes on and shoots everybody else? That's not a very sensible answer. That was Gandhi's answer. And Gandhi had the magnetism to make it stick. Gandhi had the magnetism to win the English Empire from India. I mean, win India from England. And he had that, but most people don't have. My guru said, if India were to practice, he said, the reason India could win by non-violent means against the English is that the English basically are gentlemen. But he said if it were against Russia, they are not gentlemen. He said that it would be like practicing non-violence. He himself faced a tiger when the tiger was coming to kill cows that they had taken to drive their carriage out into the jungle. But he looked at this tiger, and the tiger, which was naturally, it would have sprung on him, seeing him between itself and the cows. But he looked at the tiger with love, and the tiger just rolled over and let him stroke it, and then he yawned and went away. But not everybody is a yogi. Not everybody is spiritual. In fact, lots of people are not at all spiritual, at least in their behavior. And so the nonviolence, Master said, if you practice it on a tiger, you may end up your practice inside this tiger's stomach. You have to be realistic. There are times, in short, and Krishna makes this point, and especially since the days of Mahatma Gandhi, people have not liked that point, but it is a reality. There are such things as righteous wars. If an enemy comes to invade you, you have to defend yourself. And you have to defend yourself in whatever way you can. If everybody in the country can have that kind of magnetism, great. But we've seen how India has fallen from that goal, from that high level of consciousness, overnight after Gandhi died. The first thing I saw was back in 1958 when I came to India, that they had taken his truthfulness even and sort of distorted it so that people were truthful in an unpleasant way. Now I'm glad they've gotten away from that one. But the truth is that there are times when war is necessary, and we are in an age right now where war is likely. And you have to accept that sometimes the truth has to be defended in whatever way is possible. When I was a child, I was essentially nonviolent. I never attacked anybody. And if anybody attacked me and I could hold him down on the ground, I would do so. I remember in school in England, one of the boys in the sick room said to me, "You dirty foreigner." And of course, to me, that only meant that it was a question of whether I had had a bath that day or not. And I had, but I said, "Well, maybe you're a dirty Englishman," meaning maybe you haven't taken a bath. And he was so furious, he leapt at my throat and was all set to beat me up. Well, fortunately, I was stronger, and so I just held him on the floor, and he was spitting up at me, and finally he calmed down, and he couldn't do anything. But I didn't want to hit the guy. He was just being stupid. Ignorance can't be blamed. You just have it or you don't have it. We want to get out of it, yes. But while you're ignorant, you can't cure people by beating them in the nose. So I always left it there. There was another time in England where another boy who was much bigger and much stronger than I and an upperclassman, I came out of the art room, and I saw him in the corridor, and he was the only one. And he shoved me, so I shoved him. I wasn't going to let a bully me, but I knew what the consequence would be, and in fact it was. And he threw me on the floor, and he beat me to a bloody pulp. "Do you give in?" No, I didn't want to give in. Finally, he just got tired of beating me. But I couldn't sit on his chest. In this case, he was sitting on mine. But in the end, he just got tired of beating me. And what happened in the end was that because I never gave in, he always treated me with respect and sort of avoided me from then on. So you will see that there are times when you can practice nonviolence, either passively by letting them beat you or actively by holding them down until they can't do any more damage. But there are other times when definitely the teaching of the Gita is on all levels. And the first level is the literal one. Arjuna had a genuine duty to defend his country, not only because he was a Kshatriya, but because he was fighting Duryodhana, who was allowing the country to go. Not only had Duryodhana stolen the land by trickery, but also he was a bad ruler and creating suffering among the people. And so it was the right of the Pandavas to rule and the right duty of them to impose a rule or take back a rule which had been stolen from them. Now, to go back, and this is not here in the Gita, but you remember how Duryodhana beat the Pandavas in the first place? He had Shakuni come, and that dice were loaded, and Shakuni was able, by trickery, to win the kingdom from Yudhisthira and the Pandavas. Frankly, I can't help thinking it was pretty stupid of Yudhisthira, but there it is. It's a part of the symbol, and I accept it as that. But you know how it is in the world? You think, well, nothing really will touch me. I'm so full of bliss, nothing can harm me. But you're still thinking, I. And that I can get involved. And so by gambling, you go into the presence of the enemy, of Satan. And gradually, he's a very subtle person. He's a very subtle force, and he can trick you through your own mental rationalizations to make you think that you're doing a good thing when you're destroying yourself. But that was the story of the Mahabharata, the dice game and the defeat of the Pandavas. But it was their right to rule, and they had been won by trickery. Now when Arjuna was out on the battlefield between the two armies, here is the deeper symbolism, because really it's all symbolic, it's allegorical of something much, much deeper than what seems on the surface, which is a good rousing tale. The going between the two armies, the two armies posed against one another, this is something that all of us face in ourselves. The battlefield, as Krishna says later on in the Bhagavad Gita, this body is Kurukshetra, this body is the field. It is about the body that he is talking about. And in this body, there are the forces of good and of evil, always pitted against each other. The spine is the particular channel through which the energy either rises or falls. In the spine, there, and mind you, one of the marvelous things about teaching the Gita today, my guru was able to give an explanation of the Gita that had never been given before, because it wasn't possible to give it before. People didn't know about energy. They didn't know about the energy that created the whole universe. They didn't know about the energy that is used in yoga practice. They didn't even know about the vastness of the universe. The thought of the ego was much more real then than it is now, when you realize that we're a part of an infinite. You know, when I was in school in England, a professor or teacher came to me and said, "Do you realize that it's been discovered that all the stars that we see are only one star system?" They didn't have the word galaxy yet. And he said that they've found, first of all, they discovered it in the what looked like a nebula in the constellation of Andromeda. They discovered it was a whole system of stars just like ours. I believe Hubble did that in 1918, but I'm not sure. But by 1936, 37, when I was in school in England, he said that there are now, it's been realized, two or even three other star systems. Well, nowadays, it is known that there are 200 billion other galaxies. In one little tiny square inch of space, there are millions upon millions of them just stretching out to infinity. When you think that this ego in relation to that is anything, it's more difficult to think that. It's easier to realize what nonsense. But that infinity is still something that, in material ways of looking at things, how could you become one with all of that? Don't you see, it's all a question of consciousness. When you can get your own consciousness away from ego, if you can understand everything there is to know about one atom, you can understand the truth of the universe. But we can never know an atom. All we can ever know is this atom of our own ego. And I put my finger here when I say ego, because the medulla oblongata, the Ajna Chakra, is the seat of ego in the body. And that's why you see people looking down their noses if they're proud, or you see a singer, let's say, who's very popular, or somebody who feels flattered, and thank you. Always, it comes from here. Ego comes from here. You know why Shiva is depicted with a half moon here? It's because the moon in astrology represents the ego. And when that ego can be transferred to the point between the eyebrows, the Kutastha Chaitanya center, in the body. That is when a master, everything he does radiates outward from this point. He has to have that little bit of ego consciousness just to keep his body going. But it is not the ego of somebody who identifies himself with the body as a worldly person is. I remember walking next to my guru. I was sort of would go on walks around the grounds at 29 Palms in the desert in the evenings when the sun had gotten a bit low. And I remember one time he was sort of hardly able to stand and I had to hold him. And he remarked after a pause, "I'm in so many bodies, it's difficult to remember which body I'm supposed to keep moving." This was his consciousness, that he had living from here, this is the spiritual eye. From here he felt one with everything. Now, once you can achieve oneness in yourself, self-realization means not to realize your ego, but to realize the divine self in you. It's not then as if you sort of think, well, huff, puff, now I've got to become one with the galaxy, and oh my God, then one more galaxy, and going on. No, it's not like that. It's once you've got to the core of reality, of even that one little atom of your ego, you understand all there is. Now that begins to make liberation and salvation seem like a possibility. You know, the only scripture in the world, the only religion, I should say, in the world, that teaches moksha or complete liberation in God is the Hindu. The Christians, well, Jesus Christ spoke of liberation, but people didn't know what he meant. Buddha spoke of liberation, they didn't know what he meant. The different great masters in different religions, the Christian tradition of marriage of the soul with God, all of these things are symbols of liberation. But only the Hindu religion as a religion teaches moksha. And this moksha, which seems like an incredible thing, and is an incredible thing, at least, is open to everybody. And what's wonderful about this book is that it makes it seem easy, possible, and it gives you hope. You know, when I asked Dana Anderson, who's an artist in America, a very fine artist, I asked her to do the painting for the illustration. I wanted to do the divine vision that's in chapter 11 of the Gita. And I asked her to do that, and she did something. And she told me she was basing it on the lines in the poem Samadhi by Paramahansa Yogananda. Volcanic bursts of doomsday cataclysms. And I woke up one morning, I thought, wait a minute, this book gives hope. And I wrote to her, and I said, what I wanted to do is to give hope and calmness and expansion. And she wrote back by email, oops. And so she had to completely redo it, but she did a beautiful job. And she, just like with my own writing, again, there's been a divine blessing on this thing. She had only a week to do something that should have taken her months to do, and it flowed. It's when you see the original, we'll have it for the opening on the 15th of September of April, I mean, in Siri Fort. I think she's done a fantastic job. It gives you the feeling of cosmic consciousness as something can't do you. Other pictures, covers of the Gita have Krishna sitting in a chariot with Arjuna, or if they try to give the divine vision, they have a thousand heads going out and so on, as it's described in the chapter 11. But it doesn't make sense. How would Krishna with all these heads? This doesn't make sense. When you think of that one consciousness that is in all people, like, you know, Kali, who is described as a terrifying creature. Indeed, it's a wonderful image. Kali dances. She represents the vibration of creation. And you notice that when she puts her foot on the breast of Shiva, who's lying there because he's beyond vibration, so as soon as her foot touches his breast, suddenly she stops. And you know, when you make a mistake, you sort of bite your tongue. We do it in the West, you do it in India, it's I've gone too far. That's what they mean in that symbol. It's not the lolling of the tongue in bloodlust. It's not that. It's, my dance stops. And then this garland of skulls, it means that she is omnipresent in all human minds. All these ancient symbols, but they've had to come through Kali Yuga. They've had to come through a period of time when people couldn't understand subtle truths, and so it became necessary for these things all to be put in symbolic form. But when chapter 11 speaks of 1,000 eyes and 1,000 faces and so on, by the way, as you know, or as you probably know, and as you, if you don't, I'll tell you right now, I don't know Sanskrit. I know many Sanskrit words, but that's the limit. I can't write it. I don't know Devanagari. How could I write the Gita? Well, I had 8 different translations, not just my gurus, but Radhakrishnan, Swami Shivananda, and many others. And if they all agreed, I felt pretty safe in just putting into good English. If there was a disagreement, I certainly took my gurus as preference, but sometimes it wasn't clear, and so I worked on it to make it contemporary English, but I have done my humble best to be accurate as well as fluent in it. And if there are mistakes, I hope not. I'm not the one to tell you. Anyway, in this Gita, all the words, all the meanings of the different people in the Mahabharata, all of them represent, you know, it's an interesting thing. When you read a life, let us say, of William the Conqueror, the main characters are, well, not William, you have to put in the protagonist, but if it's somebody living in his time, they will fictionalize William. Their real characters are the ones they've created. In the Mahabharata and the Gita, Vedavyasa took the literal characters as the main characters. And the others were chosen for the fact that their names in their Sanskrit roots are, they all have meanings. What you have is the different human qualities, arrogance, pride, lust, possessiveness, desire, all of these are symbolized by the different warriors in the Bhagavad Gita. The symbolism of the good people within you, and you notice a certain passage in the beginning. Some translators, and I could see easily, you know, an interesting thing, some passages in the Gita were too difficult for many people even to think about. They just didn't, they would go from stanza to say 20 to 24 and hope you didn't notice that they had left out those passages. Because they really, some of the passages are pretty difficult to understand, but with my guru's help, I had no problem. Everything just flowed. With his help, it just became clear. But the thing is that the battle between the good and the bad, Arjuna and Krishna go between the two, and it says, as I was starting to say in the first chapter, our side, our warriors are easy to count, their side are difficult to count. Some translations said our side, that means Duryodhana in this case, our side is invincible, it's impossible to fight, whereas theirs is easily fought, easily beaten. Well, that was not a true prediction. They were beaten, but the meaning of it was not that they were difficult to beat, it was that they were difficult to count because they were so many. The ways in which you can err are legion. There are millions of ways you can sink into delusion. Some people will like a glass of wine red, another one will like it pale, another one will like whiskey, another one will like rum. They all like to get drunk, however. However, each of these things is illustrative of the fact that our capacity for delusion is endless. Once you get away from the source in yourself, you see that the world is full of opportunities for becoming satisfied. There's a very scary thing here in the Gita where it points out that you've been not only many, many lifetimes in this body, but maybe many days of Brahma. There are endless ages produce one day of Brahma. Endless yugas produce one day of Brahma. And how many days of Brahma we've been going, it just seems incredible, but it's a fact. Because men, he will say, oh, here's this beautiful girl, and once she disillusions him, as human beauty will in the end, it cannot but. And if it doesn't, okay, come around next time, you know, find out. There's always this other one here, and this other one, and this other one. And you could go through the whole roster of the human race and still not be satisfied. And so, as it takes 5 to 8 million lives, as the Shastras say, to reach the human level, once you've reached the human level, you can get, man has the capacity to imagine all sorts of things. He can go on for millions, for billions of years, for maybe days of Brahma. It's a scary thing. As it says in the Bhagavad Gita, with the beginning of a day of Brahma, throw the whole throng out again. And if you think that, well, all I need to do is wait till the end of a day of Brahma and then I'll achieve oneness with God, you don't. You remain in seed state, like seeds in wintertime, lying buried in the soil until the spring rains and sun and warmth sprout it, and it sprouts into a tree again or a flower. But you, as a human being, can go on and on, and a night of Brahma just means you get a little rest, and when you come back, it starts all over. Think about it. I've had many young men come to me, young women come to me, saying, well, I'd like to become a monk, but my mother doesn't want me to. I had the good karma, I have to call it that. The day that I found Autobiography of a Yogi was the very day I had put my mother on the ship to join my father in Cairo, Egypt. They didn't have planes in those days. There was no way that she could fly back when she heard what I had done. The day that I put her on that ship was the day I found Autobiography of a Yogi. And I read that book, and I wanted to be cautious, and so I didn't decide immediately. I took the next bus the next day, one day. And I went nonstop, 4 days and four nights, until I came to Los Angeles. I went to the church. And again, an interesting thing. They told me at the back table that all his appointments are solidly booked for 2 months. And I was aghast. I had thought, my gosh, everything I've ever done, the doors just open. And here's the one thing I really wanted, and I can't even see him. I've come all this way. And I thought, I was discouraged, but I thought, well, maybe I'm not ready. That was the unusual thought in my mind. I was arrogant, let's face it. Pretty stupid. And so I thought, maybe I'm not ready. And I started to go to the door to leave, and I thought I would just live in the mountains and come down for Sunday services and see him when I could and all of this. When this lady at the desk came over and stopped me, and she said, well, since you've come from so far, I will ask Master if he will see you. So the Divine Mother was already operating through her mind. And when he agreed to see me, and when he saw me, he said, I want you to know that I am not seeing you because you have come so far. A lady came last week from Sweden and wanted to see me, and I did not see her because God did not tell me to see her. I only do what God tells me to do. And so it was also in the desert. Before he went out there, he said, I asked Divine Mother whom I should take out with me to help me with the editing. And your face appeared, Walter. He called me Walter. And then he said, I asked her twice more to be sure. I mean, was he doubting? I don't know. Thinking, oh my God, not this man. I don't think that was the reason. I think that he was trying to implant in everybody's minds that he... this really was Divine Mother's wish that I go and help him. Now, why should I help him? I was 23. I was not tried as an editor, as a writer. I had been writing. I had wanted to be a writer. How did it happen? He had his own editor, the one who helped him with the autobiography. He had a professional editor, Carol Neely, who was being paid to come. She was a devotee, but not a disciple. What did he mean? Well, in fact, during the time that I was with him, I never got to really edit anything. I had the manuscript there. I offered many editorial suggestions, but my handwriting is there, but it was never used. What did he mean? I understand now what he meant. Later in life, when I would be enough able to do this, I would start. In 1990, I began by editing The Essence of Self-Realization, his sayings. And I did the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. I did this Conversations with Yogananda. I redid the Science of Religion. Now it's called God is for Everyone. But all of this was a preparation for a book that I thought was going to take me 10 years. I was absolutely flabbergasted to see that every day 10 pages were getting done. I'd go out to a dinner. I'd go out to some function I had to lecture at. I had to go here and there, give satsangs in our center. And every day I would come back. Some days I would think I can't possibly, but it's as if some force drove me to it. 10 pages a day. Sometimes I went as far as 23 pages, but in less than 2 months, suddenly it was all there. I couldn't believe it. But the thing is then that this symbolism in the Gita also was made clear by Yogananda in a way that could not have been done sooner, because our understanding of the universe is deeper. And in that first chapter, it doesn't seem like a very important chapter. Indeed, it's one of the most important, because in that first chapter, Krishna is already lining up these forces of good and evil. Now, this is another aspect that most people don't understand. The vertebrates, and we're vertebrates, we have a spine. And in man, the upper part of the spine is the part of the spine that shows the energy is moving up toward union with the higher self. The lower part is moving toward union with the lower self. And you notice that dogs, whose energy is in the lower sense, they have tails. When they're happy, they wag their tails. When man is happy, he smiles. When man is happy, he feels energy going upward. This upward movement of energy is something we could talk about now, which was more or less hinted at before, because great yogis have known these things. But in trying to put it in a way that people would understand them, they have been at a loss until this age, when people understand automatically, for example, that matter itself is energy. Now, the reason for being midway, actually the midway point is the heart. When the heart's energy moves upward, then you're on the path to enlightenment. But the trouble is the heart can go either direction. I remember I said to Anandamoyi Ma once that I felt such freedom in my heart. And she very wisely said, but be careful, because the energy from the heart can go up or down. And you have to get that energy and keep it moving. When people in bhakti yoga do chanting and so on, their energy goes outward. That's not the way to direct it. You have to take that energy and move it upward. So after you, I know when I was sitting, Prabhupada, Swami Bhaktivedanta, who first came to San Francisco when I lived there. So I used to go and be with him because he enjoyed talking Bengali with me. And so I had a sort of special attention there. But I noticed that at the end of their chanting, they always started moving. That's the time you should sit still. When you've chanted and awakened your energy, that's the time to sit still and direct that energy upward in meditation. So midway between the two is really the heart. From here you have the upward chakras, and from here also you can go down into the lower chakras. In the Bhagavad Gita, it talks about all of these. Tamo, Rajo, Sattvaguna. Rajo is more in the heart. It rules desire. It makes you want things. It makes you desire things and be restless. Tamoguna is that which pulls you downward. In the SRF Gita, they make the statement that what tamasic people can do to help themselves get out of that state is this. Well, you can't get out of that state. You can't tell a tamasic person, here's what you do to become less tamasic, because a tamasic person sees no reason not to be tamasic. That's the reason it's called tamas. And as Krishna puts it, he's defining the three gunas again. He says that the divine is present in nature as fire, but hidden As fire is hidden by smoke, that's sattva-guna. As the mirror is hidden by dust or rust, and as the babe is hidden in the womb. With a little puff of meditation, the smoke of maya is cleared and you see the fire of divinity. When rajaguna is applied properly, you can use your energy to seek him, and you can rub a little bit and the image becomes clearer. But in a tamasic person, there's nothing to be done. They can only, all they can do is wait. The best thing you can do for a tamasic person, he has no wish to help himself, but you can help him by giving him good company. This is why it's good to have servants. They can be uplifted by being in the houses of people who are of a higher caliber, higher interest. And this, again, in the Indian scriptures, it's very important to understand that although human beings are all equally human, they manifest different traits, not only tamo, rajo, and sattva guna, but also the shudra, the vaishya, the kshatriya, and the Brahmin state. These are not things that you're born to. My father was certainly a vaishya, but I'm not a vaishya. I remember he told me when I was 16 years old that he wanted to buy me a tuxedo so you can go to operas and big parties and so on. I said, Dad, don't bother, I'll never wear it. In fact, I'm never going to earn enough money to pay income tax. And it proved to be true. I don't know how I knew at 16, but it was just somehow bred into me. The son of a Shudra is not necessarily a Shudra. The son of a Brahmin is not necessarily a Brahmin. This came into being long ago when Brahmins began to want their children to be Brahmins. And so they imposed this genetic thing on people, saying that the son of this caste is that caste. And it's been the curse of India. I remember telling a young Indian in business back in 1959, as an American, my natural tendency is to think how you can do things better. So I suggested to him something that he could do to have greater success in his business. And the interesting thing was his answer. He didn't answer on the basis of whether my idea was a good idea or a bad idea. He said, well, but you see, this is how my father did it. That kind of culture that is bound by what your forefathers have done is what has held India back. Thank God for computers. Nobody today can say, well, but my father did computers this way. It's a whole new game. The biotechnology, it's a whole new thing. And so more and more young Indians are realizing that they can't just be bound by what their fathers did. There's a wealthy man in Bangalore who put out the money to take a whole village of outcasts and educate them, build a school for them, give them the money to start business and so on. And within a very short time, the little children's ambition is not to be a sweeper, it's to be a rocket scientist. It's to be a atom physicist or something. The ability is there in everybody, but not everybody shows it in his own nature. I, for example, perhaps because I was born too long ago, I absolutely refuse to learn how to get onto the internet. People have shown me. I just say, I don't want to know. I prefer to be an old fogey. Well, this is how it is. People get into their own particular ruts, and I'm satisfied with my rut. It's given me what I've accomplished. I don't need to learn a whole thousands of new ways of doing it, and I can go on in my clunky way and write books and lead communities and write music and everything I've done, and with sufficient effectiveness not to have to learn the programs that will make it possible to do anything better. But okay, that's just me. And the truth is that people who are accustomed to doing things, you take an old culture like India's, it's very difficult to change. They are set in their ways. And when you go out from Delhi into the country, into the villages, where they don't even speak English, and you realize that it's going to take a long time to change this. But it is coming. It can't help but come. I know when I lived here before, I visited Vinoba Bhave, and he told me I should learn Hindi. And of course, I'd love to know Hindi. I'm trying. The trouble is every time I talk Hindi with somebody, he answers me in English, so it doesn't help me. But the fact is that Hindi, I thought then, Hindi is okay for this part of the country, but in the South, it's as much a foreign language to them as English is. And I just didn't like the idea of English being taken away, because English is a great leg up that India has had in embracing the modern world. It's the doorway to the world. And English, let's face it, is a language you just about need to know in this day's world. So I'm very glad that India is now teaching English too. And in the villages, I hope that they will teach it also. You know, there are four things I want to do still here. One is to start a community in India. Another is to start an institute, a yoga institute of living wisdom. You've all got, or you can get, a little pamphlet on the subject of what I'm trying to do with that institute. And a third is a monastery, and a fourth is an interreligious temple. These things I hope to do. This morning, Nirmala is in a village that has offered us land and may be interested in working with us. It would be wonderful. The school there, the owner of the school died, the person running it, and the school had to close down. We'd love to take it over, and yes, we'll teach them Hindi, but I'd like to teach those kids English too. I'd like to, in the institute, teach people how to teach children. You know, we have schools in America that are doing this, and they're having a wonderful success. The children from our schools go to the highest fifth percentile in the country in exams and so on. It's a great system, and I'm not going to talk about it now, but do look into it. Anyway, I hope by the end of this talk even, we might have news on it. At least by tomorrow morning, I hope to be able to say, can we or can we not? At any rate, if we don't, something's got to come, because this is what I hope to do here in India. Well, to come back to the Bhagavad Gita, in this battle, the king of king material desire, Master called him. Duryodhana is the king because he's material desire. That's what he represents. An interesting thing is Bhishma is the ego. And you notice that the ego in the Mahabharata, Bhishma, I should say, has the grace not to die until he gives his own life up. And at the end of his life, he's riddled with arrows, lying on this bed of arrows, at least the way he's depicted. I can't quite imagine it, but anyway, he should have died, and he's not. And he gives a long discourse, and however, doesn't give up his body until he chooses to. This is a wonderful symbol. The one thing that nobody can take from you is your own ego. You yourself have to offer your ego into the infinite consciousness. You yourself have to say, I'm tired of being this limited being, trying to always protect my interests. Why did you insult me? Why? Oh, how nice it was that you praised me, and so on. If you yourself can reach that point where you realize that I don't want that anymore, it's too petty, it's too small, I'd rather embrace the whole universe. When you have that decision and you offer yourself, then and then only can you become, do you become, a Jivanmukta. Now the stages of liberation are this, that first of all you go into Sabhikalpa Samadhi. You know the stages of Patanjali. I'm not going to give you the explanation of his Eightfold Path. But when you reach Sabhikalpa Samadhi, you still have not achieved, and this is another mistake made in the other Gita. They say you're free with Sabhikalpa. Master himself told me, you won't be free until you reach Nirvikalpa Samadhi. At first in Sabhikalpa, you come out of that state and return to ego consciousness. And he told me about several saints who had achieved Sabhikalpa Samadhi and still came down and fell. After Nirvikalpa, you cannot fall because you have gotten rid of the last vestige of ego. Are you then completely free? Yes and no. You are free in the sense that you are one with the infinite. But you still have in your subconscious all the buried samskaras, karmas, that need to be worked out of those, who knows, days of Brahma, I don't know, long time anyway, for sure. And you have all those thoughts about you, yourself, when you were a pirate, when you were a businessman, when you were a teacher, when you were a mother, when you were a father, when you were this thing and that thing, all these different things that you have been, you have to go back into all of those and release them into the infinite by understanding it was God who played that role. Now, in a way, and again, I've used this illustration here, it's sort of like a bar magnet. A bar magnet is not a magnet as long as the molecules are turned every which way, canceling each other out in effect. But if you could turn all those molecules in a north-south direction, then the metal would achieve magnetism. Unfortunately, apart from the fact there are billions and billions and billions of those molecules in a single bar of steel, let us say, apart from that, if you were to get in there and turn each one, not only would it take forever, but by the time you reached a certain level, the other ones, not having enough power in their magnetism yet developed, would begin turning in random directions. I had this experience many years ago. I was trying to be a better person. I tried to overcome faults, and I tried to develop the qualities that would make me more worthy of God, etc., etc., etc. I would find that it was like washing a dirty shirt. You know, you wash a shirt in a tub of water and there's a bubble there. So you try to push the bubble down and it just comes over here. And so while I was concentrating on overcoming one fault, another fault would come up. And while I went over to rush this other one began. I realized it was just hopeless. I did not know what to do. I really just was at my wit's end until I found Autobiography of a Yogi. Mind you, when I read that book, I had never heard the word guru. I had never heard the word, well, maybe I'd heard the word yoga, but I don't think so. I hadn't heard the word karma or dharma or any of those words that are common currency today. I didn't know what they were all about. When I read that book, I thought, here at last is somebody who can give me what I want to know. You have to have a guru. There are two ways that you can make a bar magnet into a magnet. One is to put it next to another bar magnet. The influence of that bar magnet will act upon the molecules and realign them in a north-south direction. Such is the importance of the guru. And without that, you need that influence. That's why this is another teaching in India that is one of the fundamental teachings of spirituality. But most people in other religions haven't understood it. You need a guru. You need someone in attunement with whom your own magnetism can develop. Mind you, it's another interesting thing. It isn't that then you become like him. You have your own molecules to orient. When I studied singing at the age of 18, my singing teacher was an old woman of 75. Well, I don't like to say old now. That's young to me. Anyway, she wasn't, yes, old woman of 75. And she told me that the voice is the only instrument that you cannot see. I can show you how to place your fingers on a piano or on a harp or how to hold your fingers on a flute or whatever it is. The voice is the one instrument. I can't show you what to do. The only way you can learn is by listening and try to imitate my placement of the voice. And she, for a while, she wouldn't even let me sing except in her presence. Then after a while, she let me practice songs on my own. But after 6 months, suddenly she stopped me in the middle of a song. And she said, that note, that's the way they should all be. 6 months. It's not easy to learn to place your voice. Well, in fact, in Indian singing, they don't teach that. It would be a good thing to teach the subtlety of getting the voice so that it comes up and past. Your voice doesn't get tired when you do that. But the point is that once I learned to place my voice correctly, I didn't develop a feminine voice. I developed my own voice. This is what the guru does. He aligns your molecules. He doesn't try to make you like him. When Yogananda wrote an Autobiography of a Yogi that he himself had a very devotional approach, and his guru was one of cold spiritual mathematics, very gyanic. He said it was disconcerting for me at first to find that my guru was so different, but he found that in attunement with him, my own devotional approach increased. So the magnetism of the guru is not a state of an attitude. It's only energy which you apply in yourself, and it helps you to become yourself. The other thing that will help a bar magnet to become magnetized is to introduce an electric current through it. In that way, orienting all the molecules in the right way. And this is what Kriya Yoga does. It passes the energy along the spine, up and down, and gradually brings all those samskaras into alignment so that your whole aspiration, without having to struggle for it, becomes north and south. This being the north of the body, the bottom of the spine being the south. And so it is that in that practice of meditation and Kriya Yoga, especially, Krishna talks about Kriya Yoga clearly again and again. Nobody could talk about it until now because people didn't understand these things. But by the practice of Kriya, you can align yourself, and if you have a guru and are attuned with him, it's often a question, does the guru have to be living? You have to at least know his disciples. I have seen people who came to Master and just wanted him to be their guru, thought of him as their guru, but never went to anybody to receive it. They didn't. You could see they hadn't gotten what they were looking for. But the people who have followed, who have taken Diksha from people who took it from him, it's his power through them that does it. As it says in the Bible, Jesus himself didn't initiate disciples. His disciples initiated them. And so it is with our path. This line continues, and it will continue on through the ages. This is a wonderful time in history that this great scripture has been brought out into the light of day. I read in the Times of India months ago, or the Hindustan Times, one or the other, where it spoke about young people. And it said that young people, it's not that they're not religious, but they want a religion that satisfies their common sense. This satisfies your common sense. You read this and you say, well, I understand. The wonderful thing about it is that it makes it seem easy. And it is easy. When you think about the yawning chasm that you have to span between your ego and infinite consciousness, it seems impossible. But somehow, the more you practice these things, the more you find these things becoming just second nature. You can all be that. Jesus didn't come here. Krishna didn't come here. Yogananda didn't come here to show us how great they were. They came here to show us our own potential greatness. We have that within us because we are all equally children of God. And you cannot say one master is greater than another. Our guru was a great world savior, had a world figure, a world mission to fulfill. A disciple of Ramana Maharshi was Sri Rama Yogi. My guru told him that he was completely liberated. I spent 4 days in his company near Nellore, in his little village, Buchira Dipalayam. And I said to him, I must have been a little cheeky, but it seemed perfectly right to say it. I said, sir, you have so much. Why don't you help many people? His answer was absolutely perfect. He said, God has done what he wants to do through this body. He was one with God. My guru was one with God. You cannot say that my guru is greater than he. He did nothing outwardly. My guru did a huge amount outwardly, but their reality was that they were both one with the same God, and you can't be greater than God. So whether you be Buddha or Jesus Christ or anybody, you cannot be greater than any other master, and your destiny is to become that yourself. It is not humility to say, oh, I'm unworthy, I'm nobody, I'm a sinner, and so on. Nonsense. Don't ever say that about yourself. You are a child of God. And the more you live in that thought and with that affirmation, the more you will find that really, although it seems so difficult to overcome this fault, to overcome that, when they seem so deep-seated in you, when the day comes that you're out of it, you'll just realize it was nothing. And so here we have the symbol of the Gita, where Arjuna doesn't like to kill these people on the opposite side, the evil side, because they're his own cousins. his uncles, his grandfather. He can't help feeling that it's a sin. You notice how clever Maya is? It persuades you with sound-seeming reasons to do the wrong thing. Just like a tamasic person who's a thief, let us say, he will rob your car to teach you a lesson that you should lock your car. This kind of reasoning. Maya has all kinds of tricky ways to fool you. But they're all a part of your consciousness. Everything that man can do is your potential. This is one of the things that brought me to God. I've looked at people who were drunks, people who were thieves, who were all sorts of things, and I thought, just a little shift in consciousness, I could be that. It was frightening. I didn't want to go that way. You just have to get out of it. But I had the faith that I can also go the other way. You know, the wonderful thing is that when you think of infinity as your potential, that is who you really are. But you have to accept, philosophically, you can't avoid the corollary that if you can go up to infinity and become one with infinity, as my guru put it, you go on until you achieve endlessness, there has to be a downward track also. And yes, you can fall. And yes, you can fall very far. And how far? There's something they didn't put in their Gita, but Master said it and I put it in. You can go as low as the level of a germ. And it's a terrible suffering, but you've got eternity, and if you want to waste your time, go ahead. It isn't that God pushes you down. You push yourself down by attraction to evil and hatred and vice, and gradually you can go lower and lower. There's a story that came out of Tibet of a lama who became an ass. He had behaved like an ass in his sexual proclivities, so why not be an ass? And so he was born in an ass's body. But you've seen animals that seem awfully human, embarrassingly human. Well, they were human, probably. Look at the monkeys. Some of their faces look awfully human. But they don't have the capacity. You can fall, and many people do. In my guru's explanation, he said, you don't fall once you reach the human level. You don't fall for more than one incarnation. But if again and again you keep sinning and get thrown down for one life, come back to be a human being, get thrown down, finally, in exasperation, you might almost put it, that the divine law pushes you farther down, and you can even be pushed down, as I said, to the level of a germ. He said there are whole galaxies that are either tamasic or rajasic or sattvic, and from these tamasic galaxies, these germs come into our planet as great invasions of germs, epidemics, and here they have to be punished by medical treatment and being killed by that and so on. It's the vastness of this universe, the vastness of the possibilities. It's amazing, but it's also extremely scary. I remember when I was a little child, I got a severe case of colitis, and I had a high fever and great fever of great delirium and so on. And my father had been reading me from the life of Huckleberry Finn, and Huckleberry Finn's father was a drunk. And in my delirium, I said, I don't want to be a drunk. I don't want to. How I got that thought, I don't know. To my father, it was funny, because of course I was nowhere near that. But probably there was some memory in my life of having gone down and just deciding, we've all done it, and just deciding, no, I don't want that. There's a certain desperation that is needed. The thought that I've had it, I've done this long enough, and I don't want to wander anymore, as my guru used to say, quoting Krishna, get away from my ocean of suffering and misery. And such is the nature of this world. And you see people smiling and walking around, but oh, the suffering when it comes. This is why religions speak of hell as being eternal. Hell is not eternal, but any suffering you go through, when you're going through it, seems as if it's endless. Why go on in this? The purpose of this scripture is to give you the courage to show you how to get out from Maya and to understand who you really are. You are a child of the infinite. And as Master said, it's a very difficult thing to reach human births. Now that you've done it, now that you've come through enough to be in this hall today, wanting to know about truth and about God and about how this one great saint reached God, why not take it personally and say, how can I do it too? You can. Every age there are a few people who slip off the treadmill of this world. And when you find Krishna saying that out of 1,000, one seeks me, and out of thousands who seek me, maybe one finds me, don't be too disillusioned by that or too discouraged by that fact. It sounds bleak until you realize that there are all sorts of worlds to go through. And even if you don't achieve moksha or higher consciousness, you can at least achieve freedom from this world. You should in this life achieve that. In fact, my guru said that all those who follow this path should at least want to be jivan mukta. And there are higher lokas in the astral world. As you know, if you've read Autobiography of a Yogi, which I imagine all of you have done, that Sri Yukteswar is incarnated on a very high loka, Hiranya loka, where most souls have come down from the causal level. But even though it seems like a long course, it doesn't have to be. If you really know that this is what you want, that's all it takes. The trouble is, there's always that thought, yes, but... And so you get sucked off. Don't be fooled. It's all a game. It's a fool. Do you know that everything, because everything is based on the principle of duality. Duality is like waves. When the waves are high, that doesn't change the ocean level. For every high wave, there has to be a trough. And so for every joy, there has to be a sorrow. For every plus, there has to be a minus. The sum total of all the aspiration of all these lives, hoping to be a success in this, hoping to make it that way, hoping this, hoping that, the sum total cannot be anything but zero. Because it has to cancel itself out. In the end, you want to become Brother Zero. In fact, I used to know a monk whose name was Shunyabhai. Brother Zero. A good name. You want to nullify all these waves in your mind and just know that you are a part of the infinite. Well, I could have talked at length on the subject of symbolism.